to an unrecognizable hulk. I still think the answer must be in the book. Why else would you have been drawn to it before coming back to this world?
And us? Susanna asked. What do Eddie and I do?
Think, Roland said. Think for your father's sakes. I do not shoot with my hand, Eddie said. He suddenly felt far away, strange to himself. It was the way he'd felt when he had seen first the slingshot and then the key in pieces of wood, just waiting for him to whittle them free. And at the same time, this feeling was not like that at all. Roland was looking at him oddly. Yes, Eddie, you say true. A gunslinger shoots with his mind. What have you thought of?
Nothing.
He might have said more, but all at once a strange image, a strange memory, intervened. Roland hunkering by Jake at one of their stopping points on the way to Ludd. Both of them in front of an unlit campfire. Roland once more at his everlasting lessons, Jake's turn this time, Jake with the flint and steel trying to quicken the fire, spark after spark licking out and dying in the dark. And Roland had said that he was being silly, that he was just being, well, silly.
No,
Eddie said. He didn't say that at all, at least not to the kid he didn't.
Eddie?
Susanna, sounding concerned, almost frightened.
Well, why don't you ask him what he said, bro?
That was Henry's voice, the voice of the great sage and eminent junkie, first time in a long time.
Ask him. He's practically sitting right next to you. Go on and ask him what he said. Quit dancing around like a baby with a load in his diapers.
Except that was a bad idea, because that wasn't the way things worked in Roland's world. In Roland's world, everything was riddles. You didn't shoot with your hand, but with your mind, your motherfucking mind. And what did you say to someone who wasn't getting the spark into the kindling? Move your flint in closer, of course. And that's what Roland had said. Move your flint in closer and hold it steady. Except none of that was what this was about. It was close, yes, but close only counts in horseshoes, as Henry Dean had been wont to say before he became the great sage and eminent junkie. Eddie's memory was jinking a little because Roland had embarrassed him, shamed him, made a joke at his expense. Probably not on purpose, but something. Something that had made him feel the way Henry always used to make him feel. Of course it was. Why else would Henry be here after such a long absence? All of them looking at him now. Even Oi.
Go on,
he told Roland, sounding a little waspish.
You wanted us to think? We're thinking already.
He himself was thinking so hard, I shoot with my mind, that his goddamn brains were almost on fire. But he wasn't going to tell old Long, Tall, and Ugly that.
Go on and ask Blaine some riddles. Do your part.
As you will, Eddie. Roland rose from his seat, went forward, and laid his hand on the scarlet rectangle again. The route map reappeared at once. The green dot had moved farther beyond Rylea, but it was clear to Eddie that the Mono had slowed down significantly, either obeying some built-in program or because Blaine was having too much fun to hurry.
Is your quartet ready to continue our fair day riddling, Roland, son of Stephen?
Yes, Blaine, Roland said, and to Eddie his voice sounded heavy. I will riddle you alone for a while now. If you have no objection.
As Din and father of your quartet, such is your right, will these be fair day riddles?
Yes.
Good.
Loathsome satisfaction in that voice.
I would hear more of those.
All right. Roland took a deep breath, then began. Feed me and I live. Give me to drink and I die. What am I?
Fire!
No hesitation. Only that insufferable smugness. A tone which said that was old to me when your grandmother was young. But try again. This is more fun than I've had in centuries. So try again. I pass before the sun, Blaine, yet make no shadow. What am I?
Wind.
No hesitation. You speak true, sigh. Next. This is as light as a feather, yet no man can hold it for long.
One's breath.
No hesitation. Yet he did hesitate, Eddie thought suddenly. Jake and Susanna were watching Roland with agonized concentration, fists clenched, willing him to ask Blaine the right riddle, the stumper, the one with the get-the-fuck-out-of-jail-free card hidden inside it. Eddie couldn't look at them, Suze in particular, and keep his concentration. He lowered his gaze to his own hands, which were also clenched, and forced them to open on his lap. It was surprisingly hard to do. From the aisle he heard Roland continuing to trot out the golden oldies of his youth. "Riddle me this, Blaine. If you break me, I'll not stop working. If you can touch me, my work is done. If you lose me, you must find me with a ring soon after. What am I?" Susanna's breath caught for a moment, and although he was looking down, Eddie knew she was thinking what he was thinking. That was a good one. A damned good one. Maybe the human heart. Blaine said, still with not a whit of hesitation. This riddle is based in large part upon human poetic conceits. See, for instance, John Avery, Saronia Hunts, Ondula, William Blake, James Tate, Veronica Mays, and others. It is remarkable how human beings pitch their minds on love. Yet it is constant from one level of the tower to the next, even in these degenerate days. Continue, Roland of Gilead. Susanna's breath resumed. Eddie's hands wanted to clench again, but he wouldn't let them. "Move your flint in closer," he thought in Roland's voice. "Move your flint in closer, for your father's sake." And Blaine the Mono ran on, southeast under the demon moon. Chapter 2. The Falls of the Hounds. 1. Jake didn't know how easy or difficult Blaine might find the last 10 puzzlers in Riddledy Dum, but they looked pretty tough to him. Of course, he reminded himself, he wasn't a thinking machine with a citywide bank of computers to draw on. All he could do was go for it. God hates a coward, as Eddie sometimes said. If the last 10 failed, he would try Aaron Deepnose Samson riddle, out of the eater came forth meat, and so on. If that one also failed, he'd probably... Shit, he didn't know what he'd do, or even how he'd feel. The truth is, Jake thought, I'm fried. And why not? He had gone through an extraordinary swarm of emotions in the last 8 hours or so. First, terror, of being sure he and Oi were going to drop off the suspension bridge and to their deaths in the River Send, of being driven through the crazed maze that was Ludd by Gasher, of having to look into the TikTok man's terrible green eyes and try to answer his unanswerable questions about time, Nazis, and the nature of transitive circuits. Being questioned by TikTok had been like having to take a final exam in hell. Then the exhilaration of being rescued by Roland, and Oi, without Oi he would almost certainly be toast now. The wonder of all they had seen beneath the city, his awe at the way Susanna had solved Blaine's gate riddle, and the final mad rush to get aboard the Mono before Blaine could release the stocks of nerve gas stored under Ludd. After surviving all that, a kind of blissed-out surety had settled over him. Of course Roland would stump Blaine, who would then keep his part of the bargain and set them down safe and sound at his final stop, whatever passed for Topeka in this world. Then they would find the Dark Tower and do whatever they were supposed to do there, write what needed writing, fix what needed fixing. And then? They lived happily ever after, of course, like folk in a fairy tale. Except they shared each other's thoughts, Roland had said. Sharing Kef was part of what Ka-Tet meant. And what had been seeping into Jake's thoughts ever since Roland stepped into the aisle and began to try Blaine with riddles from his young days was a sense of doom. It wasn't coming just from the gunslinger. Susanna was sending out the same grim blue-black vibe. Only Eddie wasn't sending it, and that was because he'd gone off somewhere, was chasing his own thoughts. That might be good, but there were no guarantees, and Jake began to be scared again. Worse, he felt desperate, like a creature that is pressed deeper and deeper into its final corner by a relentless foe. His fingers worked restlessly in Oi's fur, and when he looked down at them, he realized an amazing thing. The hand which Oi had bitten into to keep from falling off the bridge no longer hurt. He could see the holes the bumbler's teeth had made, and blood was still crusted in his palm and on his wrist, but the hand itself no longer hurt. He flexed it cautiously. There was some pain, but it was low and distant, hardly there at all. "Blaine, what may go up a chimney down, but cannot go down a chimney up?"
"A lady's parasol," Blaine replied in that tone of jolly complacency which Jake, too, was coming to loathe.
"Thank ye, Si Blaine. Once again you have answered true. Next, Roland."
The gunslinger looked around at Jake, and his look of concentration lightened a bit. It wasn't a smile, but it went a little way in that direction, at least, and Jake was glad.
"What is it, Jake?"
"My hand. It was hurting like crazy, and now it's stopped."
"Shucks," Blaine said in the drawling voice of John Wayne. "I couldn't watch a hound suffer with a mashed-up forepaw like that, let alone a fine little trail hand like yourself, so I fixed it up."
"How?" Jake asked.
"Look on the arm of your seat."
Jake did, and saw a faint gridwork of lines. They looked a little like the speaker of the transistor radio he'd had when he was 7 or 8. "Another benefit of traveling Barony class," Blaine went on in his smug voice. It crossed Jake's mind that Blaine would fit in perfectly at the Piper School, the world's first slow-trans dipolar nerd. "The hand-scan spectrum magnifier is a diagnostic tool also capable of administering minor first aid, such as I have performed on you. It is also a nutrient delivery system, a brain pattern recording device, a stress analyzer, and an emotion enhancer which can naturally stimulate the production of endorphins. Handscan is also capable of creating very believable illusions and hallucinations. Would you care to have your first sexual experience with a noted sex goddess from your level of the tower, Jake of New York? Perhaps Marilyn Monroe, Raquel Welch, or Edith Bunker?" Jake laughed. He guessed that laughing at Blaine might be risky, but this time he just couldn't help it. "There is no Edith Bunker," he said. "She's just a character on a TV show. The actress's name is, Jean Stapleton. Also, she looks like Mrs. Shaw. She's our housekeeper. Nice, but not, you know, a babe." A long silence from Blaine. When the voice of the computer returned, a certain coldness had replaced the jocose, "ain't we having fun" tone of voice. "I cry your pardon, Jake of New York. I also withdraw my offer of a sexual experience." "That'll teach me," Jake thought, raising one hand to cover a smile. Aloud, and in what he hoped was a suitably humble tone of voice, he said, "That's okay, Blaine. I think I'm still a little young for that anyway." Susanna and Roland were looking at each other. Susanna didn't know who Edith Bunker was. All in the family hadn't been on the tube in her when. But she grasped the essence of the situation just the same. Jake saw her full lips form one soundless word and send it to the gunslinger like a message in a soap bubble. Mistake. Yes, Blaine had made a mistake. More, Jake Chambers, a boy of 11, had picked up on it. And if Blaine had made one, he could make another. Maybe there was hope after all. Jake decided he would treat that possibility as he had treated the graph of river crossing and allow himself just a little. 2. Roland nodded imperceptibly at Susanna, then turned back to the front of the coach, presumably to resume riddling. Before he could open his mouth, Jake felt his body pushed forward. It was funny, you couldn't feel a thing when the mono was running flat out, but the minute it began to decelerate, you knew. "Here is something you really ought to see," Blaine said. He sounded cheerful again, but Jake didn't trust that tone. He had sometimes heard his father start telephone conversations that way, usually with some subordinate who had F-U-B, fucked up big. And by the end, Elmer Chambers would be up on his feet, bent over the desk like a man with a stomach cramp, and screaming at the top of his lungs, his cheeks red as radishes, and the circles of flesh under his eyes as purple as an eggplant. I have to stop here anyway, as I must switch to battery power at this point, and that means pre-charging. The mono stopped with a barely perceptible jerk. The walls around them once more drained of color and then became transparent. Susanna gasped with fear and wonder. Roland moved to his left, felt for the side of the coach so he wouldn't bump his head, then leaned forward with his hands on his knees and his eyes narrowed. Oi began to bark again. Only Eddie seemed unmoved by the breathtaking view which had been provided them by the Barony coach's visual mode. He glanced around once, face preoccupied and somehow bleary with thought, and then looked down at his hands again. Jake glanced at him with brief curiosity, then stared back out. They were halfway across a vast chasm and seemed to be hovering on the moon-dusted air. Beyond them, Jake could see a wide, boiling river. Not the Send, unless the rivers in Roland's world were somehow able to run in different directions at different points in their courses, and Jake didn't know enough about mid-world to entirely discount that possibility. Also, this river was not placid, but raging, a torrent that came tumbling out of the mountains like something that was pissed off and wanted to brawl. For a moment, Jake looked at the trees which dressed the steep slopes along the sides of this river, registering with relief that they looked pretty much all right, the sort of firs you'd expect to see in the mountains of Colorado or Wyoming, say. And then his eyes were dragged back to the lip of the chasm. Here the torrent broke apart and dropped in a waterfall so wide and so deep that Jake thought it made Niagara, where he had gone with his parents, one of three family vacations he could remember, two had been cut short by urgent calls from his father's network, looked like the kind you might see in a third-rate theme park. The air filling the enclosing semicircle of the falls was further thickened by an uprushing mist that looked like steam. In it, half a dozen moonbows gleamed like gaudy, interlocking dream jewelry. To Jake, they looked like the overlapping rings which symbolized the Olympics. Jutting from the center of the falls, perhaps 200 feet below the point where the river actually went over the drop, were two enormous stone protrusions. Although Jake had no idea how a sculptor, or a team of them, could have gotten down to where they were, he found it all but impossible to believe that they had simply eroded that way. They looked like the heads of enormous, snarling dogs. "The Falls of the Hounds," he thought. There was one more stop beyond this, Dasherville, and then Topeka. Last stop. Everybody out.
"One moment," Blaine said. "I must adjust the volume for you to enjoy the full effect."
There was a brief, whispery, hooting sound, a kind of mechanical throat clearing, and then they were assaulted by a vast roar. It was water, 1 billion gallons a minute for all Jake knew, pouring over the lip of the chasm and falling perhaps 2,000 feet into the deep stone basin at the base of the falls. Streamers of mist floated past the blunt, almost faces of the jutting dogs like steam from the vents of hell. The level of sound kept climbing. Now Jake's whole head vibrated with it, and as he clapped his hands over his ears, he saw Roland, Eddie, and Susanna doing the same. Oi was barking, but Jake couldn't hear him. Susanna's lips were moving again, and again he could read the words, "Stop it, Blaine, stop it!" But he couldn't hear them any more than he could hear Oi's barks, although he was sure Susanna was screaming at the top of her lungs. And still Blaine increased the sound of the waterfall until Jake could feel his eyes shaking in their sockets, and he was sure his ears were going to short out like overstressed stereo speakers. Then it was over. They still hung above the moon-misty drop. The moonbow still made their slow and dreamlike revolutions before the curtain of endlessly falling water. The wet and brutal stone faces of the dog guardians continued to jut out of the torrent. But that world-ending thunder was gone. For a moment, Jake thought what he'd feared had happened, that he had gone deaf. Then he realized that he could hear Oi still barking and Susanna crying. At first these sounds seemed distant and flat, as if his ears had been packed with cracker crumbs. But then they began to clarify. Eddie put his arm around Susanna's shoulders and looked toward the route map.
"Nice guy, Blaine."
I merely thought you would enjoy hearing the sound of the falls at full volume, Blaine said. His booming voice sounded laughing and injured at the same time. I thought it might help you to forget my regrettable mistake in the matter of Edith Bunker. My fault, Jake thought. Blaine may just be a machine, and a suicidal one at that, but he still doesn't like to be laughed at. He sat beside Susanna and put his own arm around her. He could still hear the falls of the hounds, but the sound was now distant. What happens here? Roland asked. How do you charge your batteries? You will see shortly, gunslinger. In the meantime, try me with a riddle. All right, Blaine. Here's one of Court's own making, and has posed many in its time. I await it with great interest. Roland, pausing perhaps to gather his thoughts, looked up at the place where the roof of the coach had been, and where there was now only a starry spill across a black sky. Jake could pick out Aiton and Lydia, old Star and old Mother, and was oddly comforted by the sight of them, still glaring at each other from their accustomed places. Then the gunslinger looked back at the lighted rectangle which served them as Blaine's face. We are very little creatures. All of us have different features. One of us in glasses set, one of us you'll find in jet. Another you may see in tin, and a fourth is boxed within. If the fifth you should pursue, it can never fly from you. What are we? A and E and I and O and U, Blaine replied. The vowels of the high speech. Still no hesitation, not so much as a whit. Only that voice, mocking and just about 2 steps from laughter, the voice of a cruel little boy watching bugs run around on top of a hot stove. Although that particular riddle is not from your teacher, Roland of Gilead. I know it from Jonathan Swift of London, a city in the world your friends come from. Thank ye, sigh, Roland said, and his sigh sounded like a sigh. Your answer is true, Blaine, and undoubtedly what you believe of the riddle's origins is true as well. That Court knew of other worlds is something I long suspected. I think he may have held palaver with the Manny who lived outside the city.
I care not about the Manny, Roland of Gilead. They were always a foolish sect. Try me with another riddle.
All right. What has...
Hold, hold. The force of the beam gathers. Look not directly at the hounds, my interesting new friends, and shield your eyes.
Jake looked away from the colossal rock sculptures jutting from the falls, but didn't get his hand up quite in time. With his peripheral vision, he saw those featureless heads suddenly develop eyes of a fiercely glowing blue. Jagged tines of lightning leaped out of them and toward the mono. Then Jake was lying on the carpeted floor of the barony coach with the heels of his hands pasted against his closed eyes and the sound of Oi whining in one faintly ringing ear. Beyond Oi, he heard the crackle of electricity as it stormed around the mono. When Jake opened his eyes again, the falls of the hounds were gone. Blaine had opaqued the cabin. He could still hear the sound, though, a waterfall of electricity, a force somehow drawn from the beam and shot out through the eyes of the stone heads. Blaine was feeding himself with it somehow. When we go on, Jake thought, he'll be running on batteries. Then Ludd really will be behind us, for good.
Blaine, Roland said, how is the power of the beam stored in that place? What makes it come from the eyes of yon stone temple dogs? How do you use it?
Silence from Blaine.
And who carved them? Eddie asked. Was it the great old ones?
It was, wasn't it? There were people even before them. Or were they people?
More silence from Blaine.
And maybe that was good. Jake wasn't sure how much he wanted to know about the Falls of the Hounds, or what went on beneath them. He had been in the dark of Roland's world before, and had seen enough to believe that most of what was growing there was neither good nor safe.
"Better not to ask him," the voice of little Blaine drifted down from over their heads. "Safer."
"Don't ask him silly questions. He won't play silly games," Eddie said. That distant, dreaming look had come onto his face again, and when Susanna spoke his name, he didn't seem to hear. 3. Roland sat down across from Jake and scrubbed his right hand slowly up the stubble on his right cheek, an unconscious gesture he seemed to make only when he was feeling tired or doubtful.
"I'm running out of riddles," he said.
Jake looked back at him, startled. The gunslinger had posed 50 or more to the computer, and Jake supposed that was a lot to just yank out of your head with no preparation. But when you considered that riddling had been such a big deal in the place where Roland had grown up... He seemed to read some of this on Jake's face, for a small smile, lemon-bitter, touched the corners of his mouth, and he nodded, as if the boy had spoken out loud.
"I don't understand either. If you'd asked me yesterday or the day before, I would have told you that I had at least 1,000 riddles stored up in the junk bin I keep at the back of my mind. Perhaps 2,000. But..." He lifted one shoulder in a shrug, shook his head, rubbed his hand up his cheek again. "It's not like forgetting. It's as if they were never there in the first place. What's happening to the rest of the world is happening to me, I reckon."
"You're moving on," Susanna said, and looked at Roland with an expression of pity which Roland could look back at for only a second or two. It was as if he felt burned by her regard. "Like everything else here."
"Yes, I fear so." He looked at Jake, lips tight, eyes sharp. "Will you be ready with the riddles from your book when I call on you?"
"Yes."
"Good. And take heart, we're not finished yet." Outside, the dim crackle of electricity ceased.
"I have fed my batteries, and all is well," Blaine announced.
"Marvelous," Susanna said dryly.
"Lush,"
Oi agreed, catching Susanna's sarcastic tone exactly. "I have a number of switching functions to perform. These will take about 40 minutes and are largely automatic. While this switchover takes place and the accompanying checklist is running, we shall continue our contest. I am enjoying it very much."
"It's like when you have to switch over from electric to diesel on the train to Boston," Eddie said. He still sounded as if he wasn't quite with them. "At Hartford or New Haven or one of those other places where no one in their right fucking mind would want to live."
"Eddie?" Susanna asked.
"What are you?" Roland touched her shoulder and shook his head.
"Never mind, Eddie of New York," Blaine said in his expansive, "gosh, but this is fun" voice.
"That's right," Eddie said. "Never mind, Eddie of New York.
He knows no good riddles. But you know many, Roland of Gilead. Try me with another."
And as Roland did just that, Jake thought of his final essay.
"Blaine is a pain," he had written there. "Blaine is a pain, and that is the truth."
It was the truth, all right. The stone truth. A little less than an hour later, Blaine the Mono began to move again.
Four. Susanna watched with dreadful fascination as the flashing dot approached Dasherville, passed it, and made its final dogleg for home. The dot's movement said that Blaine was moving a bit more slowly now that it had switched over to batteries, and she fancied the lights in the Barony coach were a little dimmer. But she didn't believe it would make much difference in the end. Blaine might reach his terminus in Topeka doing 600 miles an hour instead of 800, but his last load of passengers would be toothpaste either way. Roland was also slowing down, going deeper and deeper into that mental junk bin of his to find riddles. Yet he did find them, and he refused to give up. As always. Ever since he had begun teaching her to shoot, Susanna had felt a reluctant love for Roland of Gilead, a feeling that seemed a mixture of admiration, fear, and pity. She thought she would never really like him, and that the Detta Walker part of her might always hate him for the way he had seized hold of her and dragged her raving into the sun. But her love was nonetheless strong. He had, after all, saved Eddie Dean's life and soul, had rescued her beloved. She must love him for that, if for nothing else. But she loved him even more, she suspected, for the way he would never, never give up. The word retreat
didn't seem to be in his vocabulary, even when he was discouraged, as he so clearly was now.
"Blaine, where may you find roads without carts, forests without trees, cities without houses?"
"On a map."
"You say true, Si. Next, I have 100 legs but cannot stand, a long neck but no head, I eat the maid's life, what am I?"
"A broom, gunslinger." Another variation ends, "I ease the maid's life, I like yours better."
Roland ignored this. "Cannot be seen, cannot be felt, cannot be heard, cannot be smelt. It lies behind the stars and beneath the hills. Ends life and kills laughter. What is it, Blaine?"
"The dark."
"Thank you, Si, you speak true." The diminished right hand slid up the right cheek, the old fretful gesture, and the minute scratching sound produced by the calloused pads of his fingers made Susanna shiver. Jake sat cross-legged on the floor, looking at the gunslinger with a kind of fierce intensity.
"This thing runs but cannot walk, sometimes sings but never talks, lacks arms, has hands, lacks a head but has a face. What is it, Blaine?"
"A clock."
"Shit," Jake whispered, lips compressing.
Susanna looked over at Eddie and felt a passing ripple of irritation. He seemed to have lost interest in the whole thing, had zoned out in his weird 1980s slang. She thought to throw an elbow into his side, wake him up a little, then remembered Roland shaking his head at her and didn't. You wouldn't know he was thinking, not from that slack expression on his face. But maybe he was. If so, you better hurry it up a little, precious, she thought. The dot on the route map was still closer to Dasherville than Topeka, but it would reach the halfway point within the next 15 minutes or so. And still the match went on, Roland serving questions, Blaine sending the answers whistling right back at him, low over the net and out of reach. What builds up castles, tears down mountains, makes some blind, helps others to see? Sand. Thank ye, Si. What lives in winter, dies in summer, and grows with its roots upward, an icicle. Blaine, you say true. Man walks over, man walks under, in time of war he burns asunder. A bridge. Thank ye, Si. A seemingly endless parade of riddles marched past her, one after the other, until she lost all sense of their fun and playfulness. Had it been so in the days of Roland's youth, she wondered, during the riddle contests of wide earth and full earth, when he and his friends, although she had an idea they hadn't all been his friends, no, not by a long chalk, had vied for the fair day goose? She guessed that the answer was probably yes. The winner had probably been the one who could stay fresh longest, keep his poor bludgeoned brains aerated somehow. The killer was the way Blaine came back with the answer so damned promptly each time. No matter how hard the riddle might seem to her, Blaine served it right back to their side of the court. Ka-slam!
"Blaine, what has eyes yet cannot see?"
"There are 4 answers," Blaine replied. "Needles, storms, potatoes, and a true lover."
"Thank ye, Si. Blaine, you speak. Listen, Roland of Gilead. Listen, Ka-tet."
Roland fell silent at once, his eyes narrowing, his head slightly cocked. "You will shortly hear my engines begin to cycle up," Blaine said. "We are now exactly 60 minutes out of Topeka. At this point, if we've been riding for 7 hours or more, I grew up with a Brady Bunch," Jake said. Susanna looked around apprehensively, expecting some new terror or small act of cruelty in response to Jake's sarcasm. But Blaine only chuckled. When he spoke again, the voice of Humphrey Bogart had resurfaced.
"Time's different here, sweetheart. You must know that by now. But don't worry. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. Would I lie to you?"
"Yes," Jake muttered. That apparently struck Blaine's funny bone, because he began to laugh again, the mad, mechanical laughter that made Susanna think of funhouses in sleazy amusement parks and roadside carnivals. When the lights began to pulse in sync with the laughter, she shut her eyes and put her hands over her ears.
"Stop it, Blaine! Stop it!"
"Beg pardon, ma'am,"
drawled the aw-shucks voice of Jimmy Stewart.
I'm right sorry if I ruined your ears with my risibility."
"Ruin this," Jake said, and hoisted his middle finger at the route map. Susanna expected Eddie to laugh. You could count on him to be amused by vulgarity at any time of the day or night, she would have said.
But Eddie only continued looking down at his lap, his forehead creased, his eyes vacant, his mouth hung slightly agape. He looked a little too much like the village idiot for comfort, Susanna thought, and again had to restrain herself from throwing an elbow into his side to get that doltish look off his face. She wouldn't restrain herself for much longer. If they were going to die at the end of Blaine's run, she wanted Eddie's arms around her when it happened, Eddie's eyes on her, Eddie's mind with hers. But for now, better let him be. At this point, Blaine resumed in his normal voice, I intend to begin what I like to think of as my kamikaze run. This will quickly drain my batteries, but I think the time for conservation has passed, don't you? When I strike the Transteel piers at the end of the track, I should be traveling at better than 900 miles an hour. 530 in wheels, that is. See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile, don't forget to write. I tell you this in the spirit of fair play, my interesting new friends. If you have been saving your best riddles for last, you might do well to pose them to me now. The unmistakable greed in Blaine's voice, its naked desire to hear and solve their best riddles before it killed them, made Susanna feel tired and old. I might not have time, even so, to pose you all my very best ones, Roland said in a casual, considering tone of voice. That would be a shame, wouldn't it? A pause ensued, brief but more of a hesitation than the computer had accorded any of Roland's riddles, and then Blaine chuckled. Susanna hated the sound of its mad laughter, but there was a cynical weariness in this chuckle that chilled her even more deeply, perhaps because it was almost sane. Good, gunslinger, a valiant effort. But you are not Scheherazade, nor do we have 1,001 nights in which to hold palaver. I don't understand you. I know not this Scheherazade. No matter. Susanna can fill you in if you really want to know. Perhaps even Eddie. The point, Roland, is that I'll not be drawn on by the promise of more riddles. We vie for the goose. Come to Pika, it shall be awarded, one way or another. Do you understand that? Once more the diminished hand went up Roland's cheek. Once more Susanna heard the minute rasp of his fingers against the wiry stubble of his beard. We play for keeps. No one cries off. Correct. No one cries off. All right, Blaine, we play for keeps and no one cries off. Here's the next. As always, I await it with pleasure. Roland looked down at Jake. Be ready with yours, Jake. I'm almost at the end of mine. Jake nodded. Beneath them, the Mono's slow trans engines continued to cycle up, that beat, 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 which Susanna did not so much hear as feel in the hinges of her jaw, the hollows of her temples, the pulse points of her wrists. It's not going to happen unless there's a stumper in Jake's book, she thought. Roland can't pose Blaine, and I think he knows it. I think he knew it an hour ago. Blaine, I occur once in a minute, twice in every moment, but not once in 100,000 years. What am I? And so the contest would continue, Susanna realized, Roland asking and Blaine answering with his increasingly terrible lack of hesitation, like an all-seeing, all-knowing God. Susanna sat with her cold hands clasped in her lap and watched the glowing dot draw nigh Topeka, the place where all rail service ended, the place where the path of their quartet would end in the clearing. She thought about the hounds of the falls, how they had jutted from the thundering white billows below the dark and star-shot sky. She thought of their eyes, their electric blue eyes. Chapter 3. The Fair Day Goose. 1. Eddie Dean, who did not know Roland sometimes thought of him as Kamai, Ka's fool, heard all of it and heard none of it, saw all of it and saw none of it. The only thing to really make an impression on him, once the riddling began in earnest, was the fire flashing from the stone eyes of the hounds.
As he raised his hand to shield his eyes from that chain-lightning glare, he thought of the portal of the beam in the clearing of the bear, how he had pressed his ear against it and heard the distant, dreamy rumble of machinery. Watching the eyes of the hounds light up, listening as Blaine drew that current into his batteries, powering up for his final plunge across mid-world, Eddie had thought, not all is silent in the halls of the dead and the rooms of ruin. Even now, some of the stuff the old ones left behind still works, and that's really the horror of it. Wouldn't you say? Yes, the exact horror of it. Eddie had been with his friends for a short time after that, mentally as well as physically. But then he had fallen back into his thoughts again.
"Eddie's zoning," Henry would have said. "Let him be."
It was the image of Jake striking flint and steel that kept recurring. He would allow his mind to dwell on it for a second or two, like a bee alighting on some sweet flower, and then he would take off again. Because that memory wasn't what he wanted. It was just the way in to what he wanted, another door, like the ones on the beach of the Western Sea, or the one he had scraped in the dirt of the speaking ring before they had drawn Jake. Only this door was in his mind. What he wanted was behind it. What he was doing was kind of, well, diddling the lock. Zoning, in Henry speak. His brother had spent most of his time putting Eddie down, because Henry had been afraid of him. And jealous of him, Eddie had finally come to realize. But he remembered one day when Henry had stunned him by saying something that was nice. Better than nice, actually. Mind-boggling. A bunch of them had been sitting in the alley behind Dolly's, some of them eating popsicles and Hoodsy rockets, some of them smoking Kents from a packed Jimmy Polino, Jimmy Polio, they'd all called him, because he had that fucked-up thing wrong with him, that club foot, had hawked out of his mother's dresser drawer. Henry, predictably enough, had been one of the ones smoking. There were certain ways of referring to things in the gang Henry was a part of, and which Eddie, as his little brother, was also a part of, the argot of their miserable little quartet. In Henry's gang, you never beat anyone else up. You sent them home with a fucking rupture. You never made out with a girl. You fucked that skag till she cried. You never got stoned, you went on a fucking bombing run, and you never brawled with another gang, you got in a fucking pisser. The discussion that day had been about who you'd want with you if you got in a fucking pisser. Jimmy Polio, he got to talk first because he had supplied the cigarettes which Henry's homeboys called the fucking cancer sticks, opted for Skipper Brannigan because he said Skipper wasn't afraid of anyone. One time Jimmy said Skipper got pissed off at this teacher at the Friday night PAL dance, this was, and beat the living shit out of him. Sent the fucking chaperone home with a fucking rupture, if you could dig it. That was his homie Skipper Brannigan. Everyone listened to this solemnly, nodding their heads as they ate their rockets, sucked their popsicles, or smoked their Kents. Everyone knew that Skipper Brannigan was a fucking pussy and Jimmy was full of shit, but no one said so. Christ, no, if they didn't pretend to believe Jimmy Polio's outrageous lies, no one would pretend to believe theirs. Tommy Fredericks opted for John Parelli. Georgie Pratt went for Ksaba Drabnik, also known around the nabe as the Mad Fucking Hungarian. Frank Duganelli nominated Larry McCain, even though Larry was in juvenile detention. Larry fucking ruled, Frank said. By then it was around to Henry Dean. He gave the question the weighty consideration it deserved, then put his arm around his surprised brother's shoulders.
"Eddie," he said, "my little bro, he's the man."
They all stared at him, stunned, and none more stunned than Eddie. His jaw had been almost down to his belt buckle. And then Jimmy Polio said, "Come on, Henry, stop fucking around. This is a serious question. Who would you want watching your back if the shit was going to come down?"
"I am being serious," Henry had replied.
"Why Eddie?" Georgie Pratt had asked, echoing the question which had been in Eddie's own mind.
"He couldn't fight his way out of a paper bag. A wet one, so why the fuck?"
Henry thought some more. Not, Eddie was convinced, because he didn't know why, but because he had to think about how to articulate it. Then he said, "Because when Eddie's in that fucking zone, he could talk the devil into setting himself on fire." The image of Jake returned. One memory stepping on another. Jake scraping steel on flint, flashing sparks at the kindling of their campfire, sparks that fell short and died before they lit. He could talk the devil into setting himself on fire. "Move your flint in closer,"
Roland said, and now there was a third memory, one of Roland at the door they'd come to at the end of the beach, Roland burning with fever, close to death, shaking like a maraca, coughing, his blue bombardier's eyes fixed on Eddie, Roland saying, "Come a little closer, Eddie, come a little closer for your father's sake." "Because he wanted to grab me," Eddie thought. Faintly, almost as if it were coming through one of those magic doors from some other world, he heard Blaine telling them that the end game had commenced. If they had been saving their best riddles, now was the time to trot them out. They had an hour. An hour! Only an hour! His mind tried to fix on that, and Eddie nudged it away. Something was happening inside him, at least he prayed it was, some desperate game of association, and he couldn't let his mind get fucked up with deadlines and consequences and all that crap. If he did, he'd lose whatever chance he had. It was, in a way, like seeing something in a piece of wood, something you could carve out, a bow, a slingshot, perhaps a key to open some unimaginable door. You couldn't look too long, though, at least to start with. You'd lose it if you did. It was almost as if you had to carve while your own back was turned. He could feel Blaine's engines powering up beneath him. In his mind's eye, he saw the flint flash against the steel, and in his mind's ear, he heard Roland telling Jake to move the flint in closer. "And don't hit it with the steel, Jake. Scrape it." "Why am I here? If this isn't what I want, why does my mind keep coming back to this place?" "Because it's as close as I can get and still stay out of the hurt zone." Only a medium-sized hurt, actually, but it made me think of Henry, being put down by Henry. Henry said you could talk the devil into setting himself on fire. Yes, I always loved him for that. That was great. And now Eddie saw Roland move Jake's hands, one holding flint and the other steel, closer to the kindling. Jake was nervous. Eddie could see it. Roland had seen it, too. And in order to ease his nerves, take his mind off the responsibility of lighting the fire, Roland had... He asked the kid a riddle. Eddie Dean blew breath into the keyhole of his memory. And this time the tumblers turned. 2. The green dot was closing in on Topeka, and for the first time Jake felt vibration, as if the track beneath them had decayed to a point where Blaine's compensators could no longer completely handle the problem. With the sense of vibration, there at last came a feeling of speed. The walls and ceiling of the Barony coach were still opaqued, but Jake found he didn't need to see the countryside blurring past to imagine it. Blaine was rolling full out now, leading his last sonic boom across the wastelands to the place where Midworld ended. And Jake also found it easy to imagine the trans-steel piers at the end of the monorail. They would be painted in diagonal stripes of yellow and black. He didn't know how he knew that, but he did. 25 minutes, Blaine said complacently. "Would you try me again, gunslinger?"
"I think not, Blaine." Roland sounded exhausted. "I've done with you. You've beaten me. Jake?"
Jake got to his feet and faced the route map. In his chest, the heartbeat seemed very slow but very hard, each pulse like a fist slamming on a drumhead. Oi crouched between his feet, looking anxiously up into his face. "Hello, Blaine," Jake said, and wet his lips.
"Hello, Jake of New York."
The voice was kindly, the voice perhaps of a nice old fellow with a habit of molesting the children he from time to time leads into the bushes.
"Would you try me with riddles from your book? Our time together grows short."
"Yes," Jake said, "I would try you with these riddles. Give me your understanding of the truth concerning each, Blaine."
"It is fairly spoken, Jake of New York. I will do as you ask."
Jake opened the book to the place he had been keeping with his finger. 10 riddles, 11 counting Samson's riddle, which he was saving for last. If Blaine answered them all, as Jake now believed he probably would, Jake would sit down next to Roland, take Oi onto his lap, and wait for the end. There were, after all, other worlds than these. "Listen, Blaine, in a tunnel of darkness lies a beast of iron. It can only attack when pulled back. What is it?"
"A bullet." "No hesitation."
"Walk on the living, they don't even mumble. Walk on the dead, they mutter and grumble. What are they?"
"Fallen leaves."
"No hesitation. And if Jake really knew in his heart that the game was lost, why did he feel such despair, such bitterness, such anger? Because he's a pain, that's why. Blaine is a really big pain, and I'd like to push his face in it just once. I think even making him stop is second to that on my wish list.
Jake turned the page. He was very close to Riddledy-Dum's torn-out answer section now. He could feel it under his finger, a kind of jagged lump. Very close to the end of the book. He thought of Aaron Deepnoe in the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. Aaron Deepnoe telling him to come back anytime, play a little chess. And oh, just by the way, old Fatso made a pretty good cup of coffee. A wave of homesickness so strong it was like dying swept over him. He felt he would have sold his soul for a look at New York. Hell, he would have sold it for one deep, lung-filling breath of 42nd Street at rush hour. He fought it off and went to the next riddle. I am emeralds and diamonds lost by the moon. I am found by the sun and picked up soon. What am I?
Dew. Still relentless. Still unhesitating. The green dot grew closer to Topeka, closing the last of the distance on the route map. One after another, Jake posed his riddles. One after another, Blaine answered them. When Jake turned to the last page, he saw a boxed message from the author or editor or whatever you called someone who put together books like this. We hope you've enjoyed the unique combination of imagination and logic known as riddling.
I haven't, Jake thought. I haven't enjoyed it one little bit, and I hope you choke.
Yet when he looked at the question above the message, he felt a thin thread of hope. It seemed to him that in this case, at least, they really had saved the best for last. On the route map, the green dot was now no more than a finger's width from Topeka.
"Hurry up, Jake," Susanna murmured.
"Blaine?"
"Yes, Jake of New York."
"With no wings, I fly. With no eyes, I see. With no arms, I climb. More frightening than any beast, stronger than any foe. I am cunning, ruthless, and tall. In the end, I rule all. What am I?"
The gunslinger had looked up, blue eyes gleaming. Susanna began to turn her expectant face from Jake to the route map. Yet Blaine's answer was as prompt as ever. The imagination of man and woman. Jake briefly considered arguing, then thought, why waste our time? As always, the answer, when it was right, seemed almost self-evident.
"Thank ye, Cy Blaine, you speak true.
And the fair day goose is almost mine, I wot. 19 minutes and 50 seconds to termination. Would you say more, Jake of New York? Visual sensors indicate you have come to the end of your book, which was not, I must say, as good as I had hoped."
"Everybody's a goddamn critic," Susanna said, sotto voce. She wiped a tear from the corner of one eye. Without looking directly at her, the gunslinger took her free hand. She clasped it tightly.
"Yes, Blaine, I have one more," Jake said.
"Excellent. Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came sweetness."
This riddle comes from the holy book known as Old Testament, Bible of King James. Blaine sounded amused, and Jake felt the last of his hope slip away. He thought he might cry, not so much out of fear as frustration.
"It was made by Samson the Strong. The eater is a lion. The sweetness is honey, made by bees which hived in the lion's skull."
"Next? You still have over 18 minutes, Jake."
Jake shook his head. He let go of Riddledy-Dum and smiled when Oi caught it neatly in his jaws and then stretched his long neck up to Jake, holding it out again.
"I've told them all. I'm done."
"Shucks, little trail hand, that's a pure D-shame," Blaine said.
Jake found this drawly John Wayne imitation all but unbearable in their current circumstances.
"Looks like I win that there goose unless somebody else cares to speak up. What about you, Oi of Midworld? Got any riddles, my little bumbler buddy?"
"Oi?"
the Billy Bumbler responded, his voice muffled by the book. Still smiling, Jake took it and sat down next to Roland, who put an arm around him.
"Susanna of New York?"
She shook her head, not looking up. She had turned Roland's hand over in her own and was gently tracing the healed stumps where his first two fingers had been.
"Roland, son of Stephen, have you remembered any others from the fair day riddlings of Gilead?"
Roland also shook his head.
and then Jake saw that Eddie Dean was raising his. There was a peculiar smile on Eddie's face, a peculiar shine in Eddie's eyes, and Jake found that hope hadn't deserted him after all. It suddenly flowered anew in his mind, red and hot and vivid, like, well, like a rose in the full fever of its summer.
"Blaine?" Eddie asked in a low tone. To Jake, his voice sounded queerly choked.
"Yes, Eddie of New York?" Unmistakable disdain.
"I have a couple of riddles," Eddie said. "Just to pass the time between here and Topeka, you understand."
No, Jake realized, Eddie didn't sound as if he were choking. He sounded as if he were trying to hold back laughter.
"Speak, Eddie of New York."
3. Sitting and listening to Jake run through the last of his riddles, Eddie had mused on Roland's tale of the Faraday goose. From there, his mind had returned to Henry, traveling from point A to point B through the magic of associative thinking. Or, if you wanted to get zen about it, via Trans-Bird Airlines, goose to turkey. He and Henry had once had a discussion about getting off heroin. Henry had claimed that going cold turkey wasn't the only way. There was also, he said, such a thing as going cool turkey. Eddie asked Henry what you called a hype who had just administered a hot shot to himself, and without missing a beat, Henry had said, "You call that baked turkey." How they had laughed. But now, all this long, strange time later, it looked very much as if the joke was going to be on the younger Dean brother, not to mention the younger Dean brother's new friends. Looked like they were all going to be baked turkey before much longer.
"Unless you can yank it out of the zone."
"Yes. Then do it, Eddie." It was Henry's voice again, that old resident of his head. But now Henry sounded sober and clear-minded. Henry sounded like his friend instead of his enemy, as if all the old conflicts were finally settled, all the old hatchets buried. "Do it. Make the devil set himself on fire. It'll hurt a little, maybe, but you've hurt worse. Hell, I hurt you worse myself, and you survived. Survived just fine, and you know where to look."
"Of course." In their palaver around the campfire, Jake had finally managed to light.
Roland had asked the kid a riddle to loosen him up. Jake had struck a spark into the kindling, and then they had all sat around the fire, talking. Talking and riddling. Eddie knew something else, too. Blaine had answered hundreds of riddles as they ran southeast along the path of the beam, and the others believed that he had answered every single one of them without hesitation. Eddie had thought much the same. But now, as he cast his mind back over the contest, he realized an interesting thing. Blaine had hesitated. Once. He was pissed, too, like Roland was. The gunslinger, although often exasperated by Eddie, had shown real anger toward him just a single time after the business of carving the key, when Eddie had almost choked. Roland had tried to cover the depth of that anger, make it seem like nothing but more exasperation, but Eddie had sensed what was underneath. He had lived with Henry Dean for a long time, and was still exquisitely attuned to all the negative emotions. It had hurt him, too. Not Roland's anger itself, exactly, but the contempt with which it had been laced. Contempt had always been one of Henry's favorite weapons. "Why did the dead baby cross the road?" Eddie had asked. "Because it was stapled to the chicken, yuck, yuck, yuck." Later, when Eddie had tried to defend his riddle, arguing that it was tasteless but not pointless, Roland's response had been strangely like Blaine's. "I don't care about taste. It's senseless and unsolvable, and that's what makes it silly. A good riddle is neither." But as Jake finished riddling Blaine, Eddie realized a wonderful, liberating thing. That word good was up for grabs. Always had been, always would be. Even if the man using it was maybe 1,000 years old and could shoot like Buffalo Bill, that word was still up for grabs. Roland himself had admitted he had never been very good at the riddling game. His tutor claimed that Roland thought too deeply. His father thought it was lack of imagination. Whatever the reason, Roland of Gilead had never won a fair day riddling. He had survived all his contemporaries, and that was certainly a prize of sorts, but he had never carried home a prize goose.
I could always haul a gun faster than any of my mates, but I've never been much good at thinking around corners.
Eddie remembered trying to tell Roland that jokes were riddles designed to help you build up that often overlooked talent, but Roland had ignored him. The way, Eddie supposed, a colorblind person would ignore someone's description of a rainbow. Eddie thought Blaine also might have trouble thinking around corners. He realized he could hear Blaine asking the others if they had any more riddles, even asking Oi. He could hear the mockery in Blaine's voice, could hear it very well. Sure he could, because he was coming back. Back from that fabled zone. Back to see if he could talk the devil into setting himself on fire. No gun would help this time, but maybe that was all right. Maybe that was all right because I shoot with my mind. My mind. God, help me to shoot this overblown calculator with my mind. Help me shoot it from around the corner. Blaine, he said, and then when the computer had acknowledged him, I have a couple of riddles. As he spoke, he discovered a wonderful thing. He was struggling to hold back laughter.
4. Speak, Eddie of New York.
No time to tell the others to be on their guard that anything might happen, and from the look of them, no need either. Eddie forgot about them and turned his full attention to Blaine.
What has four wheels and flies?
The town garbage wagon, as I have already said.
Disapproval?